Hey guys, this right here is going to be the ACLS's meat and potatoes chapter. This is going to be everything cardiovascular. So this is going to cover all your fatal arrhythmias. We're talking about VTAC, you're talking about VFib, asystole. When you look on ultrasound, you're looking at cardiac standstill, stuff like that, you know. This right here is just going to go over your ACLS algorithm. You're going to learn about your shockable rhythms versus your non-shockable rhythms, like PEA and asystole, and your shockable rhythms, which are going to be VFib and pulseless VTAC. But regardless, those are your shockable versus non-shockable rhythms. I should know better, but I don't. But again, my recertification is coming up pretty soon, so I'll learn them, and then there you go. This right here is the meat and potatoes of the AHA's ACLS provider handbook and their algorithm for handling the lethal cardiac rhythms. I hope you guys enjoy, and just a reminder, I am not endorsed or sponsored by the AHA or their affiliates. This is just me providing material that is complicated and trying to dumb it down or make it more simple for people like me that are a little bit thicker headed. Okay. I hope you guys enjoy.
Patient's here.
That old boy got some blood going.
Yeah, they have blood.
Well, he's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle, appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, was caved in, and she was hanging out parked in front of the window.
She has 22 in her left hand.
45 minutes of CPR. We can stop CPR.
6 over.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you're working in high acuity settings, maybe you're an ER nurse prepping for your ACLS cert. Well, You know these protocols are absolutely vital.
They really are. But just memorizing a flowchart, that's not going to cut it when things get chaotic in the trauma bay or the ICU.
Exactly. It's not just about the steps.
Right. ACLS often gets taught like this rigid sequence, but clinical practice, it demands so much more. It demands critical thinking, you know?
Understanding the why.
Precisely. Why this specific drug? Why now? What are we actually trying to change physiologically? What's the measurable goal?
And that's what we're diving into today. A real clinical deep dive into advanced cardiac life support. We'll synthesize the algorithms, the key medications, the teamwork aspects.
All focused on that underlying rationale, and ultimately it's about maximizing patient outcomes, which often comes down to one crucial metric.
Chest compression fraction, CCF.
Yep.
If you truly understand the metrics that drive perfusion, things like CCF, like ETCO2, then you're not just checking boxes for a certification. You become a much more effective member of the code team. It's about context and putting it all together.
Okay, let's start right at the foundation, the core concepts. Mm. Because everything else, the drugs, the shocks, it all supports one thing.
Immediate, high-quality CPR, uninterrupted.
So why the intense focus in ACLS on minimizing those interruptions? What's the core physiology we're desperately trying to protect?
It really boils down to coronary perfusion pressure, CPP. That's probably the single best predictor we have for achieving ROSC, return of spontaneous circulation.
Okay, CPP. How is that actually defined?
It's the pressure difference driving blood flow into the heart muscle itself, calculated as aortic diastolic pressure minus the right atrial diastolic pressure.
Okay.
And here's the key. The heart muscle, the myocardium, gets perfused primarily during diastole when it's relaxing.
So during CPR, our compressions are what generate that aortic pressure. Exactly. They create that diastolic pressure needed to perfuse the coronaries.
And there's a minimum threshold for that.
Yes. Generally, you need a CPP above, say, 15 or maybe 20 millimeters of mercury to keep the myocardium viable. Below that, not good.
And pausing compressions
kills your CPP. instantly. When you stop, that pressure just plummets. Yeah. And the really bad part is it takes several compressions, maybe, you know, 5, even 10 seconds after you restart, just to build that pressure back up to a useful level.
Wow. So 15-second pause for a rhythm check isn't just 15 seconds lost.
No, it's much worse physiologically. You've lost that 15 seconds, plus the time it takes to rebuild effective CPP. Maybe it's closer to 25 or 30 seconds of inadequate perfusion. That's a huge setback. It actively hurts the chance of ROSC.
It really underscores the urgency. Every second counts.
Absolutely. It's the ultimate time crunch. Which brings us to that initial assessment. You walk in, patient's unresponsive, maybe not breathing normally. What's that critical sign we have to catch, the one that sometimes fools people?
You mean agonal gasps.
Exactly. Agonal gasps. They don't look like normal breathing at all. Might be a snort or a groan, maybe like a weak snore. People sometimes think the patient's fighting or just struggling to breathe.
But they're not.
No. It's a brainstem reflex, basically, from severe hypoxia in the first few minutes of cardiac arrest. The clinical pearl is crucial. Agonal gasps are a sign of cardiac arrest.
So if you see that in an unresponsive patient,
you call for help and start CPR immediately. Don't wait for them to stop gasping entirely. That delay is critical time lost. Hashtag tag B, high quality CPR metrics.
Okay, so if CPP is the physiological goal, then the practical steps to get there are the big four quality metrics for CPR. Let's really nail these down.
Yeah, these have to be automatic. Number one, rate and depth.
Okay.
Rate is 100 to 120 compressions per minute, not faster, not slower. And depth for an average adult is at least 2 inches or 5 centimeters.
Why is hitting both so important?
Well, shallow compressions obviously don't generate enough pressure, right?
Yeah.
But going too fast, say over 120, can actually reduce the time for the chest to recoil properly.
Which brings us to number two, complete chest recoil. Why is letting the chest fully expand between compressions so vital?
Recoil is all about venous return. When the chest fully expands, it creates negative pressure inside the thorax.
Okay.
That negative pressure literally sucks blood back into the heart, refilling the ventricles. If you lean on the chest even slightly,
you prevent that filling.
Exactly. You reduce preload, so the next compression pumps less blood less effectively. It's a common mistake, leaning.
Got it. So rate and depth, full recoil, numbers 3 and 4 are about time.
Right. Minimizing interruptions. We already talked about CPP, so keeping those pauses for rhythm checks or pulse checks under 10 seconds is absolutely key.
Which leads directly to the overall performance score.
Number 4, chest compression fraction, or CCF.
Which is?
It's the percentage of the total resuscitation time that you are actually delivering compressions. Mm. Your hands are on the chest pushing. The goal is ideally greater than 80%.
80%, that sounds demanding.
It is. Think about everything that interrupts compressions. Rhythm checks, pulse checks, charging the defibrillator, pushing meds, airway procedures. Achieving over 80% requires incredible team coordination and efficiency.
It means anticipating the next step.
Totally. The next compressor needs to be ready before the 2 minutes are up. Meds need to be drawn up and ready to push during compressions. The defibrillator needs to be charging before you call for the rhythm check.
So systems and feedback are key here.
Absolutely. This is where benchmarking comes in. High-quality resuscitation isn't just about trying hard. It's about measuring performance. Lots of modern defibrillators have feedback devices, or software can track CCF in real time.
So you can see your score.
Yeah. If your team consistently hits only 60 or 70% CCF, you know there's a process problem. Maybe transitions are slow. Maybe med administration causes delays. You can pinpoint it and fix it.
Okay, so patient is down, no normal breathing or just gasping.
Yeah.
We start high-quality CPR immediately. What's the very next step in the system?
Get the monitor defibrillator on the patient, stat. This is the critical decision point.
Because we need to know the rhythm.
Right. Is it shockable? That's ventricular fibrillation, VF, or pulseless ventricular tachycardia, PVT. Or is it non-shockable? That's asystole, or pulseless electrical activity, PEA. That initial rhythm dictates the entire algorithm path.
And this is where that high-performance teamwork shines, right?
Yeah.
Compressions shouldn't stop for pad placement.
Definitely not. While compressor one is going, someone else must be applying the pads, connecting the cables, getting ready, all while compressions continue. Concurrent activity is essential.
Okay, let's say it is a shockable rhythm, VF or PVT.
The compressor keeps going until the defibrillator is fully charged and ready. Then the person operating the defib calls clear. Everyone physically backs away, you deliver the shock, and then...
Immediately resume compression.
Immediately. No delay, hands back on the chest the instant it's safe, minimize that peri-shock pause. We aim for under 5 seconds, ideally. Any delay there is just lost perfusion.
All right, Let's walk down those two main algorithm pathways, starting with the shockable rhythms, where time is absolutely critical. Hashtag tag A. The shockable rhythm pathway, VF pulseless VT.
Okay, VF and pulseless VT. These are essentially electrical chaos rhythms. VF is completely disorganized electrical activity. PVT is...
Okay, so we see VF on the monitor. We charge, clear, shock. What is the absolute most important next step?
2 minutes of immediate, high-quality, uninterrupted CPR.
No pulse check. No rhythm check right after the shock.
Absolutely not. Not after the first shock, unless you see obvious signs of life. You know, the patient starts moving purposefully, coughing, breathing normally. Otherwise, the heart muscle is stunned, even if the shock worked electrically. It desperately needs perfusion from CPR to recover and potentially start beating effectively again.
Okay, let's walk through the sequence, integrating the drugs now. Epinephrine comes in after the second shock attempt, right?
Correct. The algorithm prioritizes electricity first. It goes like this.
Back one.
Shock one is delivered, then immediately 2 minutes of CPR.
Then
rhythm check. If it's still VF-PVT, shock two. Immediately followed by 2 minutes of CPR, and during this CPR cycle, you give the first dose of epinephrine, 1 milligram IV or IO.
Okay, epi after shock two. Then what?
Rhythm check again. Still VF-PVT. Deliver shock three. Immediately start 2 minutes of CPR. And now, during this cycle, you consider and administer an antiarrhythmic.
So electricity first, then add epi, then add an antiarrhythmic if needed.
That's the sequence. Epi is then repeated every 3 to 5 minutes, which usually works out to about every other 2 minute cycle or rhythm check.
And that timing for the nurse is crucial. Get the epi ready so it can be pushed right at the start of that CPR cycle after the second shock.
Yes, push it during compressions to minimize any potential pause. Same for the antiarrhythmics after the third shock.
Which antiarrhythmics are we talking about?
Primarily amiodarone. The first dose is a 300 milligram bolus IVIO. If VF-PVT persists or recurs after that, a second dose of 150 milligrams can be given.
And if amiodarone isn't available or contraindicated?
Lidocaine is the alternative. The dose is 1 to 1.5 milligrams per kilogram for the initial bolus. These drugs are specifically for refractory VF-PVT, meaning it hasn't responded to the initial shocks in epinephrine, hashtag tag BA, the non-shockable rhythm pathway, assistal IPEA.
All right, now let's switch gears completely. What if that initial rhythm check shows a systole or PEA?
Now the focus shifts entirely. There's no shockable electrical problem to fix. So defibrillation is out. The priority becomes high-quality CPR and figuring out why the heart stopped.
Let's start with a systole, the flat line.
First step with a systole, confirm it's real. Is it truly a flat line or could it be a technical issue? Are the leads disconnected? Is the gain turned down too low? Could it be very fine VF that just looks like a systole?
Check your connections, check another lead, turn up the gain.
Exactly. Rule out the simple stuff. If it's confirmed a systole, you start CPR immediately.
Okay. Now, PEA, pulseless electrical activity. This one feels like the real diagnostic puzzle.
It really is. You see, organized electrical activity on the monitor could be slow, could be fast, could look almost normal. But when you check for a pulse, there's nothing. The patient is clinically dead despite the ECG rhythm.
What's happening physiologically there? Electromechanical dissociation.
That's the classic term. The heart's electrical system is firing, but it's not translating into effective mechanical contractions. Or maybe it is contracting, but there's nothing to pump because of profound preload failure.
Like massive blood loss.
Exactly. Or cardiac tamponade, or a huge PE blocking outflow. The electrical activity is there, but the pump isn't working effectively.
So for both a systole and PEA, since there's no shock involved initially, what's the immediate medication step?
Epinephrine. 1 milligram IV or IO, given as soon as possible. As soon as you have vascular access established, push the epi.
No waiting for a certain number of cycles like in VF-PVT.
Correct. Get it in immediately and then repeat it every 3 to 5 minutes, just like in the shockable pathway. But the absolute core of managing a systole PEA while CPR is ongoing is step two.
Searching for the underlying cause.
Yes, the H's and T's. This is where the team leader really needs to be thinking diagnostically. Why is this patient in PEA or a systole? What reversible cause can we find and treat right now?
Let's quickly run through the most common H's and T's an ER nurse might encounter and potentially reverse.
Okay, the H's. Top two are hypovolemia and hypoxia. Always consider these first. Is the patient bleeding? Dehydrated? Give fluids, give blood. Is the airway patent? Are they oxygenating? Check tube placement, listen to breath sounds, ensure good ventilation.
What else in the H's?
Hydrogen ion, acidosis, need a blood gas for that. Hyperkalemia, again, need labs, but consider causes like kidney failure and hypothermia, especially in trauma or exposure patients.
And the T's, these often need a procedure.
Right. Think mechanical problems. Tension pneumothorax, diagnosed clinically usually. Check breath sounds, tracheal position. Needs immediate needle decompression.
Okay.
Tamponade, cardiac tamponade fluid choking the heart. Look for muffled heart sounds, JVD. Needs pericardiocentesis. Can be dramatically effective.
Then there are toxins and thrombosis.
Toxins, overdoses. History is key here. Might need specific antidotes. Thrombosis, meaning a clot, either pulmonary PE or coronary massive MI. These are tougher to treat emergently during the code itself, but recognizing them is crucial for guiding post-ROSC care or deciding if thrombolytics are an option.
The bottom line for PA systole is keep doing high-quality CPR, give epi early and often, but actively hunt for and treat those H's and T's.
That's it. Finding and fixing a reversible cause is your best shot at getting ROSC in these rhythms.
Okay, let's dive deeper into the key medications. Understanding how they work helps anticipate effects and troubleshoot. Hashtag tag A, vasopressors and access.
Epinephrine. It's the star player, like you said. 1 milligram IV or IO every 3 to 5 minutes in all cardiac arrest rhythms.
And its main benefit in arrest comes from which receptor effect?
Primarily, it's alpha-1 adrenergic agonism. That's the key.
Explain what that alpha effect does during CPR.
It causes potent vasoconstriction in the peripheral blood vessels, clamps everything down. This dramatically increases systemic vascular resistance, or SVR.
Okay, high SVR. How does that help?
By jacking up SVR, you increase the diastolic pressure in the aorta. Remember our CPP calculation. Aortic diastolic pressure minus right atrial pressure. Boosting that aortic diastolic pressure is what drives blood flow into the coronary arteries during the relaxation phase of CPR compression.
So it improves heart perfusion directly.
That's the main goal in arrest. While epi also has beta effects increasing heart rate and contractility, those are less critical during the no-flow state of arrest compared to the vital need to maintain coronary and cerebral perfusion via vasoconstriction.
Let's talk access. Getting that drug into the central circulation quickly is paramount. 4 is preferred.
Carvey's best, yes. But if you can't get a peripheral IV quickly, you absolutely must go for IO intraosseous access. Don't waste time. Guidelines suggest establishing IO within 60 seconds if IV attempts fail.
That's fast.
It needs to be. And here's a huge nursing pearl for peripheral IV administration. You have to flush it properly.
Meaning?
After you push the 1 milligram of epi, immediately follow it with a 20 ll bolus of normal saline. Push it fast, and then elevate that extremity for 10 to 20 seconds.
Why the flush and elevation?
Because if you just push 1 milligram, which is often only 1 millivilli fluid, into a peripheral vein in the arm or hand, it might just sit there in the vein. The flush and elevation physically propel the drug towards the central circulation so it can actually work. Without that, your timing could be completely off.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
What about the endotracheal route, sometimes mentioned as a last resort?
It's really not recommended anymore. Absorption via the lungs is extremely unreliable and unpredictable.
So avoid it if possible.
Absolutely. If it's the only option you have, the dose needs to be increased typically 2 to 2.5 times the IVIO dose and diluted in 5 to 10 milliliters of sterile water or saline. But there's another problem.
What's that?
The drug, especially if not well aerosolized, can coat the end of the ET tube and potentially interfere with your end-tidal CO2 monitor reading. And that monitor is critical. So ET route is truly a last-ditch problematic option. Hashtag ShagB, antiarrhythmics.
Okay, moving on to the antiarrhythmics used for refractory VFPDT. Amiodarone first?
Amiodarone. It's a class 3 antiarrhythmic. A complex drug, kind of a workhorse. Its main mechanism relevant here is blocking potassium channels in the heart cells.
And blocking potassium channels does what electrically?
It prolongs the action potential duration, the AP, and also lengthens the refractory period. Basically, it slows down the electrical signaling and makes the heart muscle less excitable, which can help break the chaotic cycle of VF or slow down VT.
Dose again.
Initial dose is a 300 milligram IVI bolus. If VFPVT continues or comes back, you can give a second dose of 150 milligrams.
And the alternative is lidocaine. How does it differ?
Lidocaine is a class IB antiarrhythmic. Its mechanism is different. It primarily blocks sodium channels.
Sodium channels, okay. Effect?
By blocking fast sodium channels, lidocaine actually tends to shorten the action potential duration in ventricular tissue and suppresses automaticity, the ability of cells to fire on their own. So it stabilizes the membrane differently than amiodarone.
So different mechanisms targeting the same problem.
Exactly, which is why if one doesn't work, sometimes the other one might. The initial lidocaine dose is 1 to 1.5 milligrams per kilogram IVIO. Hashtag tag C, electrolyte special drugs.
What about magnesium sulfate? Does it have a routine role?
No, definitely not routine. Magnesium sulfate in ACLS has one very specific indication, Torsades de Pointes.
That polymorphic VT associated with a long QT interval?
Precisely. If you see Torsades on the monitor, then you give magnesium, typically 1 to 2 grams IV or IO, usually infused over about 5 to 20 minutes. But for standard VFPVT or a systolic PEA, it's not indicated.
And sodium bicarbonate. Feels like it used to be given more often.
It did. But routine use is not recommended and can actually be harmful. Bicarb administration generates carbon dioxide. If the patient isn't being ventilated effectively, that CO2 builds up, crosses into cells, and can worsen intracellular acidosis.
So when is it appropriate?
Its use is reserved for specific situations, primarily severe documented metabolic acidosis that isn't correcting with CPR and ventilation, or known severe hyperkalemia. You're treating one of the H's from the reversible causes list based on lab values or strong clinical suspicion, not just throwing it in routinely. Hashtag tag IV, airway monitoring, and ROSC management.
This part is so crucial because it's how we know if what we're doing is actually working. Let's talk quantitative waveform capnography, ETCOs.
Yes. If you have an advanced airway in place, ETCF monitoring is arguably the most important non-invasive monitoring tool during CPR.
Why is it so valuable?
Because the amount of coheros exhaled is directly related to the blood flow through the lungs, which in turn is generated by your chest compressions. It's a real-time indicator of pulmonary blood flow and thus cardiac output from CPR.
So low ETCO means?
Low ETCO means poor perfusion. Specifically, if your ETCO-Euro is persistently less than 10 millimeters of mercury, that's an objective sign that the quality of chest compressions is likely inadequate. Someone needs to push harder, faster, or allow better recoil. It's immediate feedback for the compressor.
And conversely, what does it tell us about ROSC?
It's often the earliest sign. When the patient's own heart starts beating effectively again, it suddenly pumps a large volume of accumulated QO from the tissues into the lungs. This causes an abrupt and sustained jump in the ETCO reading.
How big a jump?
Often spikes to 40 millimillion HG or higher, or at least into the normal range of 35 to 45 millimillion HG. This jump frequently happens before you can even feel a palpable pulse. So watching that waveform is key. A sudden sustained rise means check for a pulse immediately. Hashtag tag B post-cardiac arrest care, the initial stabilization phase.
Okay, the ETCO jumps, we confirm a pulse and blood pressure. We've achieved ROSC. Fantastic. But the work isn't over.
Not by a long shot. The immediate post-cardiac arrest phase is critical for neurological outcome. The brain is incredibly vulnerable after being ischemic.
What are the top priorities for airway and breathing right after ROSC?
Two big things to avoid, hyperventilation and hyperoxia.
Why is hyperventilation bad?
Ventilating too fast or too deeply blows off too much KEDO. Low KELIO, hypocapnia, causes cerebral vasoconstriction, reducing blood flow to the already injured brain. Plus, excessive ventilation increases pressure inside the chest, which can impede venous return to the heart and lower cardiac output.
So specific targets are needed.
Yes. If you have an advanced airway, the goal is about one breath every 6 seconds. That's 10 breaths per minute. You want to titrate ventilation to achieve a normal PEGO level, typically 35 to 45 millimillion HG.
And avoiding hyperoxia, too much oxygen.
Correct. While we ensure adequate oxygenation, flooding the patient with 100% IO-Euro for prolonged periods after ROSC might increase oxidative stress and reperfusion injury. So we titrate the PEGO-Euro down to maintain the oxygen saturation, SpiRO, between 92% and 98%. Don't aim for 100%.
Got it. Next priority, hemodynamics. Blood pressure.
Absolutely critical. Hypotension after ROSC is devastating for the brain and other organs. We must treat it immediately. The target is usually a systolic blood pressure, SBP, greater than 90 millimillion HG, or a mean arterial pressure, MAP, greater than 65 millimillion HG.
First line treatment for hypotension.
Fluids. Give a bolus of 1 to 2 liters of isotonic crystalloid, like normal saline or lactated ringers. See if that brings the pressure up.
And if fluids aren't enough?
Then you move immediately to vasopressor infusions. Drugs like norepinephrine, epinephrine, or dopamine drips titrated to achieve and maintain that target SBP90 or MAP65. Don't delay starting pressors if fluids fail. Hashtag tag C. Targeted temperature management, TTM.
Okay, the final piece of immediate post-ROSC care that significantly impacts brain recovery. TTM, targeted temperature management. Who needs this?
TTM is indicated for all adult patients who remain comatose, meaning they don't follow commands after achieving ROSC from cardiac arrest, regardless of the initial rhythm.
So if they wake up and follow commands, no TTM needed.
Correct. But if they remain unresponsive, cooling should be initiated as soon as possible, often started in the ER with cold IV fluids or external cooling devices.
What's the temperature target?
The current recommendation is to select and maintain a constant target temperature between 32 degrees C and 36 degrees C. That's 89.6 degrees air up to 96.8 degrees air.
For how long?
For at least 24 hours. The key is achieving the target temperature and then maintaining it stably using a cooling system with a feedback loop to prevent overshooting or temperature swings.
How does cooling help?
It reduces the brain's metabolic rate and oxygen demand, suppresses inflammatory pathways, reduces cerebral edema. Basically, it helps mitigate the secondary brain injury that occurs after blood flow is restored.
Now, a crucial point for the ER. What if the post-ROSC ECG shows a STEMI? Does TTM delay going to the cath lab?
Great question. No, TTM should not delay necessary coronary reperfusion. If the patient has evidence of an acute coronary occlusion, like STEMI, causing the arrest, getting them to the cardiac cath lab for percutaneous coronary intervention, PCI, is the top priority.
So stabilize, initiate TTM measures, but get them moving to PCI concurrently.
Exactly. You can start cold fluids while arranging transport. Reperfusion of the culprit artery takes precedence over achieving the target temperature before the procedure. Both are critical, but fixing the plumbing comes first in that scenario.
Let's touch on some specific situations that require adapting the standard ACLS approach. These can really throw a wrench in things if you're not prepared. First, ACLS in pregnancy.
Yeah, cardiac arrest in a pregnant patient, especially later in pregnancy, say, at or beyond 20 weeks gestation, presents a unique and critical challenge.
Why is it different?
It's mostly mechanical. The gravid uterus, the large pregnant belly, compresses the major blood vessels in the abdomen, the inferior vena cava, and the aorta. This is called aortocaval compression.
And that compression does what?
It severely reduces venous return to the heart. Less blood getting back means less blood the heart can pump out, even with good compressions. It dramatically decreases the effectiveness of CPR.
So what's the single most important intervention during CPR for these patients?
Manual left uterine displacement, or LUD. Someone on the team needs to be dedicated to physically pushing the uterus off those vessels, displacing it towards the patient's left side throughout the entire resuscitation attempt.
Just manually push the belly to the left.
Essentially, yes. Get your hands on the right side of the uterus and firmly displace it laterally to the left. This relieves that pressure and can significantly improve CPR effectiveness. Without LUD, your efforts might be futile.
And if CPR with LUD isn't achieving ROSC quickly?
Then the team must immediately consider and prepare for a perimortem cesarean delivery.
A C-section during the code?
Yes. The evidence suggests the best chance for both maternal and fetal survival occurs if the baby is delivered very rapidly, ideally within 5 minutes of the mother's cardiac arrest time.
5 minutes. That requires incredible coordination.
Immense. You need OB, neonatology, anesthesia, surgery, everyone mobilized instantly. The primary goal of the C-section in this scenario is actually to save the mother by relieving the aortocaval compression, which might allow ROSC. Saving the baby is a secondary, though obviously important, goal, hashtag BB, management of patients with an LVAD.
Okay, another complex scenario. The patient with a left ventricular assist device, or LVAD, especially the newer continuous flow models.
Right. These patients often don't have a palpable pulse because the LVAD provides continuous, non-pulsatile blood flow. So the standard check pulse step doesn't apply in the same way.
So how do you assess for arrest or inadequate perfusion?
You have to look at other signs, check their mental status, skin color, temperature, capillary refill, listen for the LVAD hum, and critically, you need to check the LVAD controller. Are there alarms? What are the power flow and speed parameters reading?
What if they look poorly perfused or the device seems off? Do you start chest compressions? This is controversial, right?
Highly controversial because compressions can potentially dislodge or damage the LVAD pump or cannulas, which could be catastrophic.
So the rule is?
The general guidance is do not perform external chest compressions if the patient appears adequately perfused despite unresponsiveness or alarms. Adequate perfusion might be suggested by things like a reasonable MAP on an arterial line, if present, maybe 50 mmHg, or a decent ETCO reading, say 20 mmHg if intubated, or just good clinical signs.
But what if they're clearly not perfused, like truly looked at, MAP is bottomed out, devices confirmed off.
Then, in that situation of confirmed inadequate perfusion or complete device failure, external chest compression should be performed as a last resort, while immediately contacting the patient's LVAD center or coordinator for expert guidance. It's a bridge attempt. Acknowledging the risks. #hashtag termination of resuscitation efforts.
Finally, the really difficult decision. When to stop resuscitation efforts in the hospital setting? What factors guide this?
It's always a clinical judgment made by the physician leading the code, often in consultation with the team and considering family wishes if known. But several factors weigh in. The duration of the resuscitation effort. How long have we been doing high-quality ACLS? The patient's initial rhythm of systole and PEA generally have a much poorer prognosis than witnessed VF. Any underlying severe comorbidities the patient has, their response or lack thereof to the ACLS interventions.
And tying back to monitoring.
That persistent low ETTO is a very strong factor. If, after 20 minutes of continuous, documented, high-quality CPR, the ETTTO remains consistently less than 10 millimeter HG, it suggests that effective circulation has not been restored and is unlikely to be.
Assuming reversible causes have been addressed.
Absolutely. You have to be confident you've considered and treated the H's and T's. And crucially, you must always confirm and honor any existing SILF. Do not attempt resuscitation DNA orders before even starting or stopping based on futility. #6E, summary and real-world translation. Okay, let's boil this all down. If you're heading into your next shift, what are the absolute key takeaways to keep front of mind during a code?
Takeaway number one seems to be focus on the perfusion metrics. Those numbers tell the story.
Exactly. Your chest compression fraction goal is over 80%. Watch that like a hawk. It's your team's report card. And your ETCO is your real-time perfusion gauge, below 10 millimill HG during CPR. Fixed compressions now above 20 millimill HG. Things are looking better. Sudden jump to 40. Check for a pulse. Use the numbers.
Key takeaway two, adopt the two-track mindset, especially for non-shockable rhythms.
Yes. For PEA and a systole, you're running parallel processes. One track is the basic CP ARIAPI algorithm. The other, equally important track, is actively hunting down and treating the H's and T's. Don't just run the clock, diagnose the cause. Who's checking for tension pneumo? Who's getting the blood gas? Who's considering tamponade?
Got it. And key takeaway three, preparation and timing prevent interruptions and delays.
Absolutely. Get that IV or IO access early. Use the flush elevation technique for peripheral meds. Pre-draw your epi, your amiodarone, your lidocaine so they're ready to push during compressions, not causing a pause. And for VF-PVT, remember every second counts for defibrillation. Minimize that pre-shock and peri-shock pause relentlessly. Charge before the rhythm check.
Excellent summary.
And maybe one final thought to leave you with, something to consider about your own unit or hospital systems. We focus so much on the arrest itself, but post-cardiac arrest care is arguably where long-term, neurologically intact survival is truly determined.
After ROSC is achieved.
Right. How quickly and reliably does your institution initiate targeted temperature management for comatose survivors? Are those strict blood pressure goals, MAP 65, consistently met and maintained within minutes of ROSC? How seamless is the transition to the cath lab if needed? It's that meticulous, controlled, critical care after the chaos that often makes the biggest difference in whether the patient walks out of the hospital okay. That transition is the ultimate test of the system.
A critical perspective. Mastering the code is essential, but optimizing that post-ROSC phase is where we cement the safe. Powerful stuff. Thank you for this incredibly insightful deep dive into the clinical rationale behind ACLS.
My pleasure. It's vital information for anyone responding to these emergencies.